afternoon, everyone. From the
Dave Kaplan Juno, it's time again for the Minority Report. And today we have a report on the activities from over in the House of Representatives by Representative Forbes Baker. Forbes, can you tell us what's been going on in the House that's of recent interest?
Jim, can I put out just a very quick rundown on the little that we did in the House, and then wind up with a resume of a talk that I had with Mr. Holdsworth, Mr. Bell, on the Pioneer Park.
It's going to be a real good idea, Forbes. We've been so heavy in committee work trying to get some of these big bills ready for passage in formal session. Might be good to let the folks know just what has been going on in formal session in the House.
There's a lot been going on if we can just get it back for passing. This morning we passed House Bill 374, which relates to the reemployment of veterans, and then House Bill number 155 on tear seal bounty. And to those of you that have access to the bills, well, you can very readily see what these are. House Bill 304 is an agricultural loan board bill, which will be of particular interest to those who are indulging in agriculture.
By the way, there was a raise in the agricultural revolving loan fund, was there not, Forbes?
Yes. Yeah,
passed the House?
Yeah, it goes up to $3 million now.
From a previous high of $2 million.
From a previous high of $2 million, and we came down here a year ago, it was at $1 million. So we've watched it go, Jim, from $1 million to $2 million to $3 million. That means available funds. And there was an extension of the jetty at Nome, which passed the House. That's a Senate Joint Resolution, and a Senate Joint Resolution number 42 with regards to withdrawal of a piece of land in Pet Ford Barrow for an airstrip. You know, there's very little important, but I did have a very pleasant and, I believe, important meeting with Mr. Holdsworth and Roscoe Bell this afternoon in company with Mr. Stratton from Anchorage, a representative out of that area, in regard to the Pioneer Park land. Now, Mr. Holdsworth, Mr. Bell are both very sympathetic with us, and I am very sure that they will go along with us 100% just as soon as we get the full cooperation, full consent of the University of Alaska and the Historical Society. This will take in the land that was in the original request of the pioneers to the westward of Fairbanks, known as Pioneer Park, and will give us not control of it in fee simple, that is, it will have no rights to dispose of the land, but we will have full right to use that land for the purpose that is set up.
What area does that cover, Forbes? How much ground is involved in this?
Oh, in the section of land, Jim, is 72 point some acres. Mr. Holdsworth and Mr. Bell both go along with that area. There's 20 acres of that that's across the airport road. And, of course, they immediately brought up the thought that it's going to be rather hard of access, but that can be taken care of by an underpass or an overpass.
Well, Forbes, is this anywhere near the Kiwanis Park that we're familiar with in the Fairbanks area?
Yeah, it's right. It's just to the west of that.
And runs right down to the Chena River.
Right down to the Chena River. It would include a harbor or a boat ramp.
Small boat landing, so folks can more readily launch their outboards and so on. It'll be a part of this park program.
And it will be a piece of land that will be 100% for the use of the people of Fairbanks as a park and recreational for all time to come.
This will include a picnic-type facility, as well as a place for placing things of historical interest.
Jim, with that amount of land, I think that they could put in a wonderful, wonderfully attractive setup of historical objects, plus the recreational area which the town of Fairbanks so badly needs.
Well, now with the cooperation of the Department of Natural Resources, how soon do you feel, Forbes, that this could become a reality?
I believe it's become a reality very, very quickly. It's just a matter of getting the three groups together and all say yes at the same time. And I think that we can carry the ball for them down here if that becomes the fact before the closing of the legislature.
Well, that's about the size of it for today, Forbes. Thanks so much for your rundown on activities in the House of Representatives. From the state capitol, Representatives Jim Binkley and Forbes Baker bringing you the Minority Report.
This tape was a transfer tape courtesy of KFRB Radio. for the Pioneer Igloo 4 historical records. And this transfer was made by the engineer at KFRB Radio. This is Harry Hughes, recording for Igloo 4.
Just give your name and this thing.
Well, my name is Edward R. Farrell. I was born in Minnesota, a little town out of St. Paul called Shakopee. And my folks left there when I was... I think about 6 years, and then we came out to Puget Sound.
What year were you born in?
1882. Yeah.
And when did you come to Alaska?
Well, the first trip to Alaska was in 1898. I came up on a little steamer. I was a dishwasher on a little steamer. And we stayed there overnight and went back to Seattle again.
That was in Skagway? You came to Skagway?
No, not then. Then I came up to Skagway and Whitehorse. ...150-mile walk down to Dawson. So we were out, I think, 3 days when we met an Irishman on the trail. He was pulling his sleigh by the neck. I talked to him for a little while and asked him how things was going. Well, he said, pretty tough. He said, if I was only back in Boston, he said, I'd promise God and the people I'd get along with the silver and never mind the gold. Well, I think we were 21 or 2 days walking. I mixed up with a fellow that was hauling in some supplies to Dawson. And once in a while I could ride, and incidentally, he was hauling a little stuff for me, too. And I think we were about 22 days getting into Dawson. Well, when I got there, there was plenty of work. I worked around the creek some, and most of the Bonanza and El Dorado. Finally got a lease on Hunker Creek. And I worked there for a while, until the stampede came up from Fairbanks here. That was started to come back in 1902. And pretty good reports, some of them. Some of them were bad, but I decided anyhow in three that I'd come to Fairbanks, which I did. And I've practically been here ever since.
How did you get to Fairbanks? Did you come over the...
No, I came on boat down to Chino, and then we, from Chino up, we poled up to Fairbanks. Well, I was on Fairbanks Creek and Clary Creek. And then in 1905, I decided I'd go to the Chotatalinica country. And we were over there, I think, for one winter and one summer, and then back to Fairbanks. We didn't find nothing over there to speak of. Well, about that time, Dome Creek was being struck. So I went on Dome Creek for a while. And from there, I went up on stampeded up on the Chena River, the way the headwaters of the Chena River to Palmer Creek. Well, we were there a little over a year, I think, and didn't. We mined there for one summer, and I think we had $40 apiece when we got through in the fall. So that didn't look very good to us. So back to Dome Creek, and I got a lease there on Dome Creek and made a little money there. Well, about that time, then the Iditarod stampede and the Ruby stampede was on. I went to Ruby. I was in 11. And when I got there, I took in the creeks, and every place I'd go, there was somebody ahead of me. And invariably, I'd run on into the same name, Mr. Johnson. So I got tired of reading Mr. Johnson's name, and finally, I came to a big spruce tree, and I squared it all off good. I wrote on this tree, I claim everything Mr. Johnson don't claim. Well, back to Fairbanks again, and then there was quite a little excitement in the Valdez country. And me and another fellow by the name of Angus McDougall, you might have known him. He had a horse, and I bought another one, and we got a buckboard, and we started out over the trail. I think we're 9 or 10 days or 11, something like that, making the trip. And there was no road to speak of then. When I got there, we got there, there was quite a crowd gathered around us, and one fellow stepped up and he said, did you come over the trail? I said, no, I came through it. The mud was about up to the axles in a lot of places, and we had to ford all the streams. Well, we did a little quartz prospecting there, and that didn't turn out. And then we went over to the Copper River country and put in the winter there and back to Fairbanks again. Well, then I went out on Pedro Creek, got a lease out there. And that didn't turn out very good. We got a hold of a piece of ground, and the ground below us and the ground above us went $1.25 a foot. Ours went 35 cents. So we didn't make any money there. And from there to Livengood. That was another hard trip. We started off from Olness with an 80-pound pack apiece on our backs. And I think we were 13 days getting into Livengood. Well, we had to pack everything we eat, and our bedding and so on. And when we got away down on the river, we didn't know exactly where we were going to go when we left here. We knew there was this strike over there, but we didn't know exactly where it was. But we got away down below the strike anyway, and it took us a couple of days more to get up to where the supposed to be the money was. And Livengood and his partner just got a hold of bedrock. We had to take a microscope to see the colors. They were so fine. Well, anyway, we staked and sank a few holes, but we didn't find a thing. But the next ones that came after us, they had to go back farther to get ground, you see, on the benches. And then the next ones after them came in, they still had to go farther back, and they were the ones who got the money. We got the experience. Well, then, back to Fairbanks again for the winter, and Ruby began to show up pretty good then. So, in the spring of 15, I started off for that 300-mile walk to Ruby. Well, I made it all right, and got down there, and the country was pretty well staked then. Made a little money right away on boiler work. I was pretty handy at repairing boilers. I made a little money and bought some ground and made a little money in Ruby.
Where did you work on Ruby?
On the Ketchum Creek, principally. Oh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I think I was in the Ruby country about 12 years. Then along about 25, I came up to Mason Creek. And was there a few years. Well, we didn't find much there. A little gold was not enough to be commercial. And from there, in about 30, I think, we went to Rampart and bought out the Idaho Bar and worked on that for two winters, in fact. Well, that wasn't much good. We could make a little money, but it was too much work for what money we'd get out of it. Well, then we bought a claim on Little Minook and worked there 2 or 3 years. Finally sold out to a fellow named Roberts. I have to stop and think now where I went from there. I came back to Fairbanks anyhow. And I think I went down on the Minto Flats and had a little trading outfit there. I was trading with the natives for one summer. And then back to Fairbanks, and then I got a drilling outfit and moved it down to where they're going to put in this dam, the Rampart Canyon, and drilled there for the foundations. But it seemed like that was the time they were going to put the railroad to Nome. But they got the Japs off of the island, and they decided that they'd abandon that idea.
I surveyed that site before you fellows went down there.
Oh, is that so?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you go on the poor man's stampede? I thought I saw you there.
Poor man? Yes, yeah. I was there. I was in 29.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was another blowout. No good. So I came back to Fairbanks and did some drilling over on Ohio Creek. And from there I went to the Seward country. I took the drilling outfit down there and was there a year and a half, I guess. That's really where I met my wife in Seward.
Well, you were on that stampede to the Yukon too, weren't you?
Oh, the fish wheel?
Fish wheel
yes,
stampede.
Yes, I took that.
I came pretty near going on that.
Well, I didn't think anything of the fish wheel picking up the gold. I didn't fall for that. But those fellas came back from over there, and he said they'd found pretty good prospects 60 feet back from the beach. Well, I told my wife, I said, I'd better be getting over there. I've taken in the rest of them. I might as well take in this, too. So, of course, that was absolutely a failure. They don't think they ever did have any gold. Was a fellow over there and had a little drill, and I put a hole down 50 feet with that drill, and we never got a color.
What was it like in Fairbanks in the early days? Can you tell us, Ed, something about that?
Well, when I got here, there was hardly any buildings here. There was a few log cabins, and Barnett had his store down there, and where the NC is now. I lived over in Grail that winter in a little cabin. I guess that's all fell in by this time. And, I put in that winter around Fairbanks Creek and Clary. And I missed it on Clary. I went over, me and another fellow went over on Clary Creek and walked down pretty well down on the lower end, and the ground was open there. So we looked it over, and the fellow's with me always says, this don't look good to me. He's quite a lot older man than I was. This don't look very good to me. There's nothing but a moose pasture down here. It's all trees, you know. So we walked away from there. About a year after that, they were drift mining down and taking out $1,000 a day there.
Yeah, I can tell stories like that about the Nome country. My father.
Yeah.
Well, where was the, were you here? You knew Pedro then also.
Oh, yes, I knew Pedro well.
Yeah. Was that strike made on Pedro Creek? Or
The first strike.
Or the mouth of Pedro and Gilmore?
Yeah, that's right. They called it the discovery on Pedro Creek. Mm-hmm. That was funny. There was a few people on Pedro, and there was a little store there. And a fellow named Charlie Mack, he was over on Fairbanks Creek. Forgot that he was on some little creek there, and he just had one claim there. And he came over to Pedro to get some supplies, and I guess he got a hold of a little mule in the meantime. He told the bunch on Pedro that they'd made a little strike on Fairbanks Creek, and he intended to go back there and stake, you see. But instead of that, he spent two or three days on Pedro Creek, and by the time he got back over there, the whole Fairbanks Creek was staked. All he had was one little claim on Crane Gulch. I guess you know where that is.
Well, tell me, was it McCarty that made that strike on Fairbanks Creek?
Yeah. Yeah, they were on Discovery Fairbanks Creek.
Do you know the story of that strike, Ed? Hmm? Do you know the story of that strike?
Well, not exactly, but just what do you mean by the story?
Well, I heard he'd tried to stake in other creeks, and they shoved him off on that, and he finally went on that.
Well, that was right. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was right. He was kind of forced onto it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was a pretty good move. He made a lot of money there.
Well, on Curry, did you hear how that strike was made? Maybe you can tell us how those strikes were made. You were here in those days.
Al Hildy was one of the first discoverers there on Clary Creek.
Well,
and Clary had quite a lot of influence on it too.
Was he there himself, Clary, or was mm-hmm. he? Was Clary there himself, or did he?
Oh yes, he was there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was a son-in-law of. He was some kind of kin to.
Barnett.
Barnett.
Well, I think he was a brother to Barnett's wife. Well, I think that's the relation there. Mm-hmm. Well, he was after Marshall here, you know, Terry.
Well, as Bonifield, he was a gambler here, wasn't he? That made
that's
us,
right. A gambler and a banker.
Mm-hmm.
Bonifield had quite a reputation as a walker. He used to start in from here and walk clear through to Hot Springs in one day, 75 miles.
So tell me, when did Ed Stroker come here? Was he wasn't he in the Circle Country before Dawson was struck?
Yeah, he was.
I thought I'd seen his name over there.
He was quite an early arrival here. He was he carried mail on the down on the Yukon and all around. Then Ed worked for he was bookkeeper for E.R. Peoples for many years here before he got in the banking business.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd like to hear about some of the old timers if you can tell us some. Who was this?
Well, the old time. I knew them all here. Old Dave Petrie and Bill McPhee, Al Moranzi. Well, I knew all of them at one time. I don't know if they ever seen that picture taken in front of the Pioneer Hotel or not.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of the old timers there. I have the picture home. I think that was taken in 1910.
Tell a little bit about Ben Falls, if you can. Oh, can you tell about Ben Falls?
Yeah, I can. Well, I took a drilling outfit over to Goose Creek last winter, and we drilled quite a few holes over there. We didn't get very good results, so I brought the outfit back to Livengood, and I got to talking to Ben, and he had that little proposition on Wilbur Creek, so we got together and did a little mining there last summer.
That was an old creek that
it
discovered in the early days, wasn't it?
Well, it was struck about the time Livengood was, around about 1913. I guess the Wilbur Creek wasn't struck until 14 or 15, maybe.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about Suckett Creek?
About Suckett?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I couldn't tell you anything more much than we took an outfit up there. I took my wife along with me. We mined there that summer. That was another blow up. And in the fall, my partner and me built a little small boat. We had just room to sit in, that about all. And we put that boat in the river, but it wouldn't hold the three of us. So my wife had to walk down about 4 miles down through the thunder. I guess she had quite a time. The river was crooked, you know, and sometimes we could hear, and I kept hollering to her every time we get close. Sometimes we could hear, and sometimes we couldn't hear. And we finally got down to out of this little creek and got into the main John River. Well, then we all three got in the boat. And we were, I think, 2 days getting down to the main Kiakuk. This boat was very cranky. I thought she was moving around all the time. I'd reach back and tell her to keep still. She says, "I am sitting still. I can't sit any stiller." Well, we had to camp on the bar one night. We didn't have no bedding. Well, we built a big fire and we slept on the bar till daylight. Pulled on down to Battles that next day.
Yes, were you on Golden Creek when out there?
Would you speak a little louder, please?
I say, were you on Dome Creek when Wickersham made that well-known decision on the Dome Creek mining, the Dome Creek suit, so-called? It was a well-known issue. I think it was around 1905 or 6.
I didn't
get to find out a little
about it. He wants to know if you were on Dome Creek when the Wickersham made the decision on some mining deal there.
Well, I was here around in the vicinity, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. That was the muck discovery you're talking about.
Yeah, it involved bedrock proof. I mean, except it was made a determination for the rest of the camps to go by from then at that point on.
I was out on Dome when Caribou Bill got shot out there. He was sinking a hole on this Barnett outfit, they called him. They went to his hole, and he was at lunch at the time, and they started to take his pick and shovel away. And he showed up on the scene about that time, and he told them to drop the pick and shovel, but I can't think of his name now. He kept right on walking. So he up with a 30-30 and plunked him right through the chest.
Were you there when Barnett went out there with two men and ran Cap Anderson off his claim?
Well, he tried to.
At one point?
He tried to, but he didn't get him off. He still stayed with it.
Well, he got him off at the time, though.
Yeah.
They ejected him, of course, at the time.
Well, they'd hire these thugs, you might call them, and they'd go out there and restake the claim. Well, then they'd get it in court. Most of the fellows didn't have any money to defend themselves, and they'd buy them off cheap, you know. That was the way they acquired a lot of the ground. I saw them there on one below. They'd stole that ground practically, and they were packing off gold and coal oil cans off from the cleanups there. How does that?
She wanted to know about the town of Fox in Goldstream Valley.
Fox was quite a little town at one time. There was, I think, three saloons there and a couple of roadhouses. There was quite a little village there one time. And Clary Creek was a big town, you might say. I don't know how many saloons and dance halls filled with. I would say one time there must have been anyway, a dozen dance hall girls around Clary. Dome Creek was about the same way.
Is there anything particularly lower Goldstream Valley?
You'll have to talk to me a lot.
No, there's
a... Lower Goldstream.
She wanted to know if there's any town in Lower Goldstream.
How they got to their claims.
She wanted to know how they got to their claims on Goldstream Valley and if there was any town in Lower Goldstream.
Well,
I guess there wasn't
much. The only way they'd get there was flat-footed.
Oh, I thought there was a railroad.
The narrow gauge, when did that go in?
Oh, the narrow gauge ran out to Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm. When was that built, Ed?
That was built, I guess, in 5 and 6.
Old Charlie Joint was the...
Yeah, he was the superintendent, yes, sir. Yeah. Well, many time I rode out on that.
Yeah, I've been on that.
Of course, that was still running when the FE came here.
The government bought it and tore it up.
Mm-hmm.
The roadbed is still there.
Yes, it's parked in there.
Mm-hmm. Will you ask him how we used to take off across country with an axe and a knife and a little stuff on your back and live? These newer people have never seen that.
Well, of course, them days you could get birds most any time, you know, and rabbits. Well, when we made that trip to Livengood, we still had a little grub coming back. I had enough rice left to give a fellow had a horse, give him a feed of rice on the way back. We went from here out to Olness on the little narrow gauge, and then from Olness on, we had to walk.
Tell me, were there many caribou in those early days in this country?
Well, we didn't into the worst caribou, all right, but not through that section that we were in that fall, anyhow. Mm-hmm.
He wants to know which mining claims you spent the most time at.
In the Fairbanks to...
Any place, I guess.
Well, I guess I put in more time on in the Ruby Country on Me Ketchum Creek than any other claim. I think we were 5 years on that one claim.
You're drift mining there?
Fifth mining, yeah. And I think we were four years on the claim on in Rampart, on Little Minook.
Roberts made quite a little money there, didn't he? Or did he? Hmm? Did Roberts make any money there afterwards?
Yes, he got out with a little money.
I thought he did. He ran it down to trucks.
Well, he went at it in a pretty expensive way. He bought four trucks. And he had a little backhaul to load it with.
Did you ever see the Blue Parky man? Yeah. Hmm? The lady wants to know who the Blue Parky man was.
Well, his name was I think they called his name was Aaron, I think they called him now. I just forgotten. Oh, there's quite a little excitement over that Blue Parky man. They had guards on the wagons coming in with the gold, you know. But he never got any cleanups.
He got some gold.
Well, he got some. But like old Cap Anderson from Dome Creek, he used to hire four or five men to come in with the cleanups. And one or two ahead and back behind with rifles. I think it was more of a show than anything else.
Well, do you know anything about that very rich bench on the left limit of Goldstream? What is that bench now?
Bigler Bench?
Bigler Bench.
Yeah. Well, I never mind on it, but of course I was here all the time they were working it. And I know they took out a lot of money off from it.
Yeah, I understand they took over $1 million.
Yeah, I guess they did. I was never lucky enough to get onto anything like that. I walked over engineer, I don't know how many times I could have staked on that. That was rich too. Of course I hadn't, them days I had a lot to learn too. I was new at the business myself. I think if it was all over, to do over again, I could have done a lot better.
Trouble. We're getting too old to do anything when we know a lot. That's right. <laughs> Well,
if anybody else want to like to ask any questions?
Well, I think we ought to get on the record
there
that he's mined most
of
his life here, and there's
still a million
opportunities that people like to go mining.
Well, I'm not giving it up yet by any means. I'm still going out.
He's 80 years old this spring, this summer.
Yeah.
Ben Paul's is 83 and he's still mining.
And you're still going prospecting, you
know? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be going prospecting till I kick off.
What about these fancy new ores? radioactive.
Have you looked for any radioactive stuff?
No, I haven't really gotten interested in that much, sir. I've been trying to stay with the gold pretty well. I've been trying to stay with it, but don't stay with me very well.
Any other questions that think of?
If anybody's got any questions they'd like to ask, why I'd be willing to try.
What do you think of the opportunities now in Alaska? What do you think of the opportunities for new finds now?
Oh, I think there's lots of country here yet.
I do too.
In fact, I know a lot of creeks that's got a good showing on right now, but never been prospected.
We'll all talk to you after the meeting. We'll get off the mat.
Well, thank you, King Regent, for coming down to our party.
Hmm?
I say thank you, King Regent. You're King Regent, aren't you?
Yeah, sure.
I say thank you.
This is February the 22nd. At 8:30 p.m. in the evening at the Tanau Yukon Historical Society, and this is Pioneer Ed Farrell, King Regent for 1962, giving the Historical Society a tape-recorded story of his life at this gathering in this meeting tonight. This is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4 at this meeting. Thank you.
budget, Jack. It's the largest budget that this state or the territory has ever seen. And it is $8 million bigger than Egan planned 60 days prior to receiving the $15 million from the oil lease money. He made a speech in Anchorage at the Penguin Club. The Democrats have a meeting there every Wednesday noon. And he made a speech at that time, Senator Coghill, that that he could balance his budget without any tax increases with $7 to $8 million from oil lease revenues, which was the Tyonic sales. Now, this was 60 days prior to the sale of the Tyonic oil properties. And 60 days after he made the speech that he could balance the state budget with $7, $8 million, he received $15 million. And, of course, the budget is just balanced now. So somewhere along the line, he raised the cost of government $7 or $8 million.
Well, Bruce, you feel that in our legislative session here that the finance committees and the members of the legislature then have their biggest responsibility to the people is to bring this budget in line with sound principles of economics and a sound approach to state government?
I most certainly do, Senator Coghill. If Egan and his administration doesn't keep the taxes in line and keep the budget in line, for instance, if we pass this $78 million budget, that will be the minimum budget from now on, because you never take it away.
In other words, you feel then that $78 million, the $70 million that he wants for fiscal year 1963, which is the beginning July 1 and ending June 30th of 63, that the $70 million for this budget and the $8 million that he's asking for supplements is actually what we would call then a runaway type spending program.
Well, the budget, as you know, Senator Coghill, you have more experience in the finance picture of the state and the territory before that than I have. But I do know that the budget has been approximately 30% increase each budget since statehood.
Well, Bruce, let's get into one little subject here that I think that you and I agree on, and that is the fact that in your family life or in your business life, you always pay your debts before you go out and buy a new car or you buy new drapes for the living room or whatever you have. And now Alaska has had hanging over its head for quite some time the unemployment debt that we have when we had this construction lull of about $9 million. Now, don't you believe that we should meet our facts head on and pay this fund back before we go spending it for a lot of fringe benefits and a lot of things that, although they might be desirable, that we should first take care of our debts?
I most certainly do. If you don't pay your debts, then naturally your future credit is in jeopardy. Now, had Egan not made this speech at the Penguin Club in Anchorage prior to this oil lease windfall, which shows definitely that he could have balanced the budget, his budget, Egan's budget, with $8 million less, and we could pay off the loan that we have received from the Reed Act on the employment security, and in this manner, we would show maturity and responsibility. The fact that we're a new state, Jack, all of the financial centers of the world are watching us very, very close to see if we're going to show financial, fiscal, and political maturity. And at this moment, Egan is not showing maturity.
So in other words, you state then that we should take care of our obligations first. Now, our time is running out, and I would like to just point out one thing for the listening audience, that our projected revenues for the next fiscal year are only $53 million, $53,776,000. Under the program that the governor is asking for, just operational budget is $10 million higher. Now, what we should do then is take our revenues that we have, our windfall that we've got in the 18 and some odd million dollars from oil and land leases, pay off our debts, place the rest of it in capital expenditures, but always stay within our income when it comes to the operation and the services for the people of the state.
That's absolutely right, Senator Coghill.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for appearing. And we'll see you again next week.
Of course, sir.
The preceding paid political program, Legislative Minority Report, is brought to you each day, Monday through Saturday at 12:15, by the Republican Legislative Group and does not necessarily reflect the views of this station.
Economic Development Committee. It was set up mainly to take advantage of not only the Area Redevelopment Act and the Rural Areas Development, or Commerce Secretary Hodges' Boost the Economy program, but other federal, state, and local programs for the economic development. I'd like to reiterate the fact that economic development is a community responsibility. You can protect your investment in your business locally, in your home, your family, and your future in this community. And one of the ways is by investing your time and your talents and your energy and your finances into this economic development. I feel that there is no one group or no individuals that have the responsibility for community development. It is for economic development. It is, as I say, a community responsibility. Now, the functions of the Economic Development Committee for the 19th Election District have been pointed out. They're very simple, and that is to keep the jobs that we now have in this area and to find new jobs for those that we are in danger of losing, and three, to create new job opportunities. And I think we should understand one thing. Senator Greening touched on it in the preview to this program, and that is that no one is going to come in and develop this area, and no group is going to do it, if by design or by the lack of design, the area doesn't want to grow economically. It takes, as we say, cooperative, coordinated effort, teamwork, if you will. Our Economic Development Committee then was formulated as a vehicle to help remove the roadblocks or the hurdles that were stifling growth and development. Now, whether these be technical or market problems or financial, we have many problems to overcome in this area, and not the least of which is the financial. That's the need for long-term, low-interest venture capital.
You mean cheap money?
Cheap money, yes, Vic. That's the popular phrase for it. Since EDC is a voluntary cooperative association with no legal base or authority, it was felt that we should have an entity that would be legally responsible to help in the goals and the aspirations and the dreams of our economic development. So out of the deliberation came the idea of Tannel Rich, which is a local development company. It's the Tannel Rich Development Corporation, a local development company that was chartered under the laws of the state of Alaska and is registered with the Security Exchange Commission. Thanks, Don. The Tannel Rich name, just as a sidelight, we hit upon the name Tannel Rich because of the Tanana Valley, the Alcan or Alaska Highway, and the Richardson Highways. That's where the name came from. But more important than the name was that the idea of Tannel Rich, as with the Economic Development Committee, which is a vehicle to help in the development, Tannel Rich was formulated, organized, and chartered to be utilized as one more tool that will help to remove these roadblocks and hurdles that are in the way of our economic development. Tannel Rich is a nonprofit community organization. In other words, no individual that's connected with the Tannel Rich Corporation can profit individually, financially. We hope that it will be a profitable corporation to the area and to the community, but it is not a profitable organization to those who are serving as its board of trustees or working to help make the Economic Development Committee a success. The idea of Tannel Rich is to provide the participation funds that are required for local development. A lot of the programs under ARA, under the SBA, require local participation. The biggest deterrent to economic growth in this area seems to be cheap money, as Vic has pointed out. Now, in 3 years at the Chamber of Commerce, whether we got into discussions of business, growth, industry, construction, tourism, agriculture, when you get right down to basics, the basic point was that we did not have, in most cases, an economical unit. And what was needed in most of these areas was $50,000 to $250,000 loans on a long-term, low-interest rate. Channel Rich, in other words, will not compete with the established commercial financial institutions. They will still be expected to provide the leadership for financing private projects and other projects within their scope. The same with the home mortgage loan associations and others. Channel Rich does not seek to replace these. We feel that the purpose of Channel Rich will be in another sphere and will be more of the type of the risk or venture or adventure type loans that, if we can put them together, will create the new jobs and will make for better economic conditions in our own locality, and here in our case, particularly the 19th Election District. This local development company was created specifically to aid projects which are feasible and which couldn't otherwise achieve the finances needed to get off the ground. Local development companies have been recognized pretty strongly since World War II. There are about 5,000 of them in the nation today, and they have been found in most communities to be one of the finest tools to aid in industrial growth and in economic development. There are many case histories of the successes that they have had. These can be recounted by looking in many communities where local development companies, with the cooperation of started by as few as 12 and as many as 20 or 30 people, have had momentous success. Now, the constitution of Channel Rich was drawn up. We used the sample constitution, bylaws, and articles of incorporation were supplied by Small Business Administration. The Channel Rich was also organized not only to take advantage of the Area Redevelopment Administration Act and the loans made available there, but also to take advantage of the loans that are made directly to local development companies through Small Business Administration. In this case, Small Business Administration, since July of 1961, when the act that provided a lot of the loans to local development companies expired, it was reinitiated under Administrator Horn, and the emphasis from the top administrators all down the line has been to participate with SBA funds through in participation with local development companies. Many of the federal employees and administrators for many of these agencies that have been here, whether it be SBA, the REA, Rural Electrification Association, or the Area Redevelopment Administration, and we've had visits from most of them who've met with our economic committee. Most of them pointed out the desire to have locally a group that could provide the local participation funds that are required to obtain these long-range, low-interest funds from government sources. So Channel Rich then was set up with these things in mind and so designed that it could take advantage of all of the programs that were known to us at the time. And part of the requirements, not only from Small Business Administration, but also from the Area Redevelopment Administration and others, is that the Board of Trustees or the Board of Directors of the local development corporation have a very wide and broad representation. On the local level, we have a 15-man board. That board was elected. It is a Board of Trustees of Channel Rich. It was elected by the Economic Development Committee of the 19th District. It has representatives not only from Fairbanks, but also from North Pole, from Delta, and from Tok. And the representation on the Fairbanks level in the local city is pretty diverse. As we say, the trustees were elected to these positions. I've mentioned some of the opportunities that are available to Channel Rich from government sources. Funds on part of the state can also be issued or can be put into Channel Rich. Municipal funds were set up to take advantage of all the sources that we can get money or pooled together will give us the seed money that we need to get the long-term or the, as Mr. Richardson pointed out a while ago, to get the cheap money. There are, of course, the loans from REA. These are provided through the Rural Areas Development Program. Under Title V of REA loans, these do not necessarily have to go through the Area Redevelopment Association either. In some cases, as in the case of the first project that our Economic Development Committee came up with and has been approved all up and down the line and has already had a technical panel here, of which Tannel Ridge is committed to help participate in, was jointly participated in by, will be jointly participated in by ARA funds, Area Redevelopment Administration, by REA, by the Small Business Administration, by a local commercial financial institution, and by Tannel Ridge. And the commitment of Tannel Ridge in this case is to come up with 10% of the local, or to come up with 10% participation of the total loan on the local level. So we will be committed to something over $30,000. And it is the wish of the trustees of Tannel Ridge that on this first go-around for our first project, that monies raised will be placed in escrow